This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. And this week the show is again sponsored by BDoc's Timeline 3D, which is an iOS application and a Mac application that lets teachers and students create and present timelines on iPads, iPhones, iPod Touches and Macs in the Mac App Store and in the iOS App Store. More information about that as the show goes along. Good evening, Bradley. How are you?
Fantastic. I am in a new Batcave. We are anticipating taking ownership of our new Apple stuff this week. Everything but my computer has shipped, which is great.
Okay.
And so that's always fun. So I have a very tiny office. I call it a cloffice, a closet slash office. And so there's some extra space, some dead space on the backside of my office. And so we have turned that into a closet. So I'm in there today. So if there's any extra noise, hopefully that'll be fixed in the next few weeks. Oh, sorry. My phone was ringing.
Perfect timing.
Yeah, that was my wife. Excellent. So sorry about that, everybody.
That's okay. Great. Yeah. So what are you getting? Are you getting, you mentioned MacBook Airs before, is that right?
Yeah. Teacher computers, 13-inch Airs, student computers, 11-inch Airs. And then the reason mine hasn't shipped yet is because it's a custom build. It's a 13, I think it's the computer you have. It's the 13-inch Air, 8 gigs of RAM, 512 SSD, and then the processor's bumped up a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly the machine I have. It's basically the 13-inch MacBook Air with everything turned up. I think that's as high as you can go. I don't think you can get a 750 gig SSD in that machine, am I right?
You can't. I'm okay with 512. My big thing is I would have liked to have done 16 gigs of RAM, especially since there's no way you can upgrade it in the future.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I don't need 512. I could probably get by with 256, but I just don't want to chance it. I guess I don't want to sit there in 2 years and regret.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly the thought process I went through as well, was I thought, well, the cost difference is, what, £380 or something, and in 3 years I'm not going to sit around wishing I had an extra £380 over that period, but I may very well be regretting the loss of half of the disk capacity for quite a long time in between.
Yeah, I always just look at it, you know, if you buy a car and you skimp out on not getting the radio that you want, it's like, you know, if you don't upgrade, get the aux input, you're going to regret that in 2 years. And if it's $300, you just won't miss that. And so it's just, you know, again, if I could upgrade later, I might stick with a 256. And I guess you can technically upgrade those drives because they're, the blades. And you can get those from OWC. But, again, I'd just rather go ahead and get it, especially since it's in a lease. You know, it's not like we're having to write a check for it today. It's just kind of, you know, paid out over the next 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, the difference is a rounding error in that overall operation that you're doing there. Cool. So what have I been up to? I mean, thank you for taking over the show for the past 3 weeks. That was awesome.
No problem. I actually had a couple of listeners email me and tell me that you could just not come back and they would be okay. I'm kidding.
Well, my wife suggested that as well, so there you go.
Yeah, my wife said, because we had a new baby coming in July, she said, no, you'll take a few weeks off, right? I said, absolutely, don't worry.
Is this officially the internet's most fertile podcast? Is that what
I think
saying?
So. I think so. Chris, I think I told you, I don't think I've really said it on Twitter, but we're having another boy. So you've got a house full of girls.
We have a house full of girls, yes. Young Georgia was born a week ago, last Monday. She's fitting well and making her presence very much known in the house. Her mother and her came home last Wednesday, it was. And then the day after that, I spent the day through in Edinburgh doing a massive day-long iOS vision and planning session for a whole bunch of schools that were there. We'll talk about that later on in the show a little bit. But that was first night with a new baby in the house, next day up at the crack of dawn, all the way over across the other side of the country, all day on the stage. It's only me. The whole thing's on me. And it was I was pretty tired on the train on the way home that day, I can tell you.
For anybody listening that doesn't have kids, you know, you see the TV shows and the movies and you hear the stories. The first 8 weeks of having a newborn child are really rough sleep-wise, but then you just kind of adjust And our thing was that we would divide up the night shift, because I always knew, like, if I could sleep from, say, 11 until 4 a.m., like, I could function. And then if my wife knew that she could sleep from, like, 4 until, like, 8 when I went to work, like, she could function. And so we just kind of split it up those 8 weeks. It was rough, but then you just slowly get your lives back to normal.
Yeah, we're definitely on the way to that, I think. I discovered this. I mean, our girls are 8 and 6 and now a baby as well. And the extent to which baby technology has advanced since our last two were babies is just incredible. I mean, there are all kinds of things now. I mean, iOS wasn't really a thing. I mean, the iPhone wasn't even out when April was a baby, and it had only been announced a month before Beth was born. So we didn't have these, you know, £300 Wi-Fi baby monitors that can ping your iPhone when the temperature gets above 18 degrees and things like that. So none of which we have bought, I might add. They're just a bit of a gimmick, in my opinion. But
well, we have a Motorola baby monitor, and I think Marco Arment did a kind of a long review of baby monitors. And the more people I talk to, the more most people don't like the Wi-Fi ones. And really, our thing is, for a couple of reasons. A, I just don't feel like I want to have my iPhone with me all the time. I want to be able to put it down, but still have that baby monitor. And it's really nice to have a dedicated device for that. But also, the one we have has a microphone in it. And so, like, at night, we basically turn the video part kind of to sleep on our receiver, but the microphone still works. So we can, if Sawyer got up and started crying or something like that, we could still hear him. And you got to think, if that's an iPhone, do you leave the app running all night? And kind of, you know, how does that work? So we like this Motorola one. I'll put the link from Amazon in the show notes. And of course, the downside of this, and this goes back, kind of brings it home to Wi-Fi, is most of the baby monitors are 2.4 gigahertz. So if you,
I was going to say that I'm cautious about bringing more RF equipment into the house from people who don't know what they're building.
Yeah, it's you know. And so I remember back when Sawyer was first born, I didn't have a dual band router at the time, and so when we would turn it on, like, everything would get really flaky, like laptops, everything got flaky just because we were, you know, in the vicinity of the receiver. And so that's when I hardwired our Apple TV, because again, I only had a 2.4 gigahertz router. And then since then I have upgraded, and of course we no longer living in that house, but we had had two access points. Both of them were dual band. You know, every device we owned was 5 gigahertz. So it was no issues. But yeah, that's one downside. And that's really kind of I know it's a first world problem that your video baby monitor is bleeding onto your Wi-Fi interference and your internet becomes a little flaky, but you know, it happens. It's especially painful if you're trying to watch Netflix or something.
Just because it's a first world problem doesn't mean it's not a problem. Right?
That's true.
Yeah, it's still a problem. So over the period, one of the things that I spent my time doing when I was not podcasting with you was I've been reading a really interesting book, actually, which I thought I'd mention. And it's called Never Mind the Laptops by an author called Bob Johnson. And I've only managed the first half of it so far because eventually Georgia was born in the middle of it. But so far, so good. In this book, it's really been interesting because what it does is it charts the history of the use of computers in education, all the way from the very earliest days when Dartmouth College put in their first computer and so on, all the way through the people installing, you know, mini computers into schools and having kids, you know, go through drill on it and so on, and then the evolution of people's thought about how the computers were used in the classroom, all the way through people like Seymour Papert and Alan Kay and people like that, all of these sort of luminaries that we know, but for those of us who work in this kind of area. And then the part I've got to now, which is about the halfway point in the book, it's when the first school in the world goes one-to-one with any kind of computer in school. The year is actually 1990. I hadn't realized it was quite that long ago. And the school is a school in Australia called Methodist Ladies College in, I think, Melbourne, Australia, if I remember that right. And just the impact that had, because not only was that the first school in the world to give every student a computer, it's also an all-girls school. So, you know, attitudes to women in technology have always been, or currently are, quite controversial as well, I suppose. And it was just interesting to see that the first school that did that, at least according to this book, was an all-girls school. So I can definitely recommend that book as a light and easy read, but also one that's quite thought-provoking as well, because it's fascinating to see that some of the arguments that people like Seymour Papert encountered, and even people before him, are the same kind of arguments that we encounter today from people who are trying to, I don't want to speak against, but people who are unconvinced by the value of computers in schools, or who feel it's not traditional enough or something like that. And so it's a very interesting book, and it certainly filled in a few hours for me over the course.
This is why I love the digital distribution model, this like kind of long tail, where that's not a book that's ever, you're probably going to find at your local big box bookstore. It just doesn't, you know, not enough people are going to buy that. But that's, you know, with Kindle and iBooks and the Nook platform, those kind of long tail books, the very niche books, can kind of live on forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think this one was about $2.50 on Kindle. I think it's an OCR conversion from a paper book, because some of the formatting is not absolutely perfect in it, but it doesn't impact your understanding of the book at all. It's just an occasional line break where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, I will be buying that as soon as we quit recording.
Yep, we'll stick the link for that in the show notes as well, so people can pick that one up. But yeah, really good book. So, what's been happening in the weeks and months since I've been here?
We had some great shows. Had Stephen Hackett on last week. We talked, had a good time. Of course, Saturday was a big day, because if you're listening to the show, you're obviously an Evernote user, because we all are, right? So I take my dog to the vet and getting the yearly checkup and a heartworm shot, and I get the and a rabies shot as well. So I get the rabies certificate, and I pull up Evernote. I'm going to go to scan it in, and I get a synchronization error. It says your passcode is no longer valid. Freaking out just a tad there. So I literally pull over into a gas station and jump on Twitter, and do find out that there's been some sort of issue with Evernote, and they have reset all the passcodes.
I mean, that happened to everybody that uses Evernote. It wasn't a selective thing in the case that sometimes, like Twitter, for example, resets some people's passwords or whatever. But in fact, as far as I understand it, they just sort of hit the reset button on the entire site for every user. So everybody had to go and make a new password this time. So big plug for password manager programs. I use 1Password. Are you a 1Password guy, Bradley?
Yeah, I've been a 1Password user for years. I did it for a year or two without having the unique passcodes, but I just use it kind of for the simple login feature. And then I guess about 2 years ago, I took a Friday afternoon and you just kind of went through, used the password generator, and you know, kind of went to town and made unique passcodes, and it's really been great. So, you know, go in there, you make a new passcode, you change it, you're off to the races.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of when you get into a situation like this where you have to do a password reset on one service or another, that because all of my passwords were unique, I know that I don't have to go around and change that password from any other site, because the one that was potentially compromised on Evernote was that was the only place I was using that. And because Evernote reset all the passwords as soon as they learned about it, then stuff's pretty secure still.
And I even take I use a unique passcode with Evernote, but I kind of take it a step further. And anything that's in there that I guess I wouldn't be comfortable, you know, kind of spilling out into the world, if it's a PDF, I encrypt that with a unique passcode that's then stored in a secure note within 1Password. And then, like, if it's a collection of files, I will take that and create a secure disk image with another unique passcode. And so, like, I've actually got, you know, disk images with passcode that have really strong passcodes inside of Evernote notes. And so, again, even if someone got into my Evernote account, they've got to go through kind of multiple layers of unique random passcodes to, you know, to get anything that's useful.
Yeah, that's a pretty solid way to do it. And the only downside to that being that, say you go on iOS, you can't access the stuff that's in those files. But typically, I guess, those are not the things that you're necessarily going to want on the go every single day.
No, just not
using Evernote as a container for them in the long term.
Yeah, it's just a place just to dump them so I know they're kind of backed up. But yeah, would be nice if there was a way, you know, even just to preview the files in a disk image. Of course, they do have a mechanism. If it's an encrypted PDF, you can, you know, unencrypt it with a passcode just to view it. But yeah, disk images kind of have to go to the Mac for that.
Yep.
And of course,
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I would love to talk to Will Stites, who we had on a few months ago, about how that affected their entire school. Do they have to come in on Monday, and how do they manage that?
Yeah, that would be interesting to hear from Will on that, because They very much have the philosophy that the individual student is the admin. So I guess that in principle, most of those students will just capably change their passcode and manage that. My biggest problem, apart from the security aspects of it, was that I had to change the password in like four different apps on three different devices. Because I'm really into using Penultimate now as well, since they integrated it with Evernote. So Penultimate, Sketch, Evernote itself, on two iPads and a phone and a computer, and it took a while to get that password everywhere.
It would make more sense, and I guess from my perspective, to treat an app like Penultimate or Sketch like you do, say, 1Password or Instapaper. Like, I have my Instapaper account linked to Evernote, so like I can actually send things from Instapaper to Evernote for kind of further saving offline. Mm-hmm. And it would make sense for me, like, that you would authorize Sketch for an entire year like you do other applications, because I didn't have to update any of those things. Like, I have Reader connected to Evernote and, again, other apps. I didn't have to update those because those use those tokens. I guess I'm wondering why Sketch and Penultimate don't follow that same model.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the answer to that is. Possibly that they assume that people may use one of those apps without using Evernote itself as such. I'm not sure about that, but rough week for Evernote.
Well, if anyone thinks that, you know, any cloud service is never going to have this issue, they're a fool. I mean, Dropbox, Evernote, every service has the potential to have this happen. I think it's just really important how the company reacts. And so far, Evernote seems to have reacted very well. I guess my only complaint was it did feel like that word traveled faster than the emails came out. Like, I didn't get the email until 5 or 6 hours later than the blog post. And I guess they obviously can't email their entire database, I guess, at once instantly from a queue perspective. But yeah, you know, if you're just a general user that doesn't know about Twitter and their blog, you're wondering why your password doesn't work. And if you'd have gotten an email, you would immediately know.
Yeah, there were updates to many of the apps not long after it happened. And I don't know if you reset any of your apps after those updates came out. But what happens now is that when you go into one of those things, it says password reset required. And then there's actual UI inside the app that helps you go through resetting your password. Now, obviously, they didn't have that in place before this incident, but I guess in future that will be the mechanism through which those things are done.
I wonder if it's like there's a button on something on their end, or if it's like some sort of command line thing. Like, wonder how they actually initiated that. Like, if it's two people have to press the button at the same time, or I don't know.
It's like that scene in Superman 2 where they're trying to launch the rocket with the dead guy with the key in one hand and a bit of string. And, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, let's take a quick sponsor break and thank BDocs. They've been a big sponsor for last year and this year. They help keep the lights on here at Out of School Headquarters. As Fraser said earlier in the show, they make an incredible timeline application for iOS and for Mac that lets teachers and students create and present timelines on the iPad, the iPhone, and the iPod Touch. It's a universal application. It's basically, you know, you have a story that you want to tell in historical context. It's perfect for that. If you can, take a picture on an iPhone, you can use this app. It's deadly powerful, but deadly simple, which to me is kind of the hallmark of iOS, that you can do these things that make you look like you should be a computer programmer, but you're really just a novice user. Timelines begin as a standard 2D chart, and then you can make them a 3D chart with a flyover effect with literally a click of a button. Users can view and interact with timelines on their devices, and timelines can be presented to larger groups using AirPlay or by connecting a display or a projector. It's literally the simplest way to make a beautiful multimedia timeline. Again, iOS and Mac availability. It's available through the iOS App Store. Normal retail is $14.99. Of course, it's been up and down. They've been shifting the price a little bit. So depending on when you listen, it may be a little cheaper than that. And it's also available through the Apple Volume Purchase Program. So if you're buying more than 20 copies, which you should if you're buying it for your classroom, it'll be half off whatever the current price is. It gets great reviews in iTunes. The guys over at BDocs are incredible guys. So thanks to them for sponsoring the show again this week. BDocs.com. We'll have a link in the show notes and on the website, outofschool.net.
Awesome. So, talk to me about OpenDNS Umbrella, Bradley.
So, we talked about this, I guess, right when they launched. And I think you had demoed it, I guess, from an iOS perspective. And I had demoed it a little bit. And we have actually rolled that out internally for the church that our school is a part of, who I moonlight as the technology person for. So, what we wanted was a way for on our ministers' computers to block pornography off-site. Again, there were no issues, but we just want to put, you know, I guess, safeguards into place, you know, so in case, you know, that we can, I guess, be above reproach was our kind of mentality. So we already use OpenDNS internally for their enterprise service that we, you know, pay for yearly and really enjoy. And I really prefer their content filtering over even the one that our firewall provides, and it's actually quite a bit less money. So we elected to deploy their desktop application on mainly Macs and then a few Windows computers. And again, your pricing will be different, I guess, per what, you know, kind of organization you are and things like that. We paid for 30 users. Now, again, that's, you can have, you know, multiple devices per user. So if you've got somebody with a phone and an iPad and a Mac, that it's one, you know, it's one user. And then we pay $1,000 per year for roughly 30 users. And which, again, is expensive, especially if you're going to deploy that for your, you know, entire student population. That could get very expensive. And I'm sure that if you had, you know, 300 students, they could drive that price down further. Again, it just depends on your situation. I know that's why they custom quote everything. But so I guess I want to talk a little bit about the deployment process and kind of how we did it and, you know, I guess how it's working. If you're using it on the Mac, you log into your account, and if you're an existing enterprise customer, they'll actually migrate your account to the new dashboard. So your enterprise service and your Umbrella kind of slash mobility service is all in one interface. On the Mac, you just download a package file. It's already got all of your information encoded into it. So like when you install it, you could theoretically put this in Apple Remote Desktop, or you could actually email it to your users, tell them to install it. There's no information they need. There's no account settings. All it does is it takes the computer name, grabs it, and basically phones home to the Umbrella servers and records that it's installed. On the PC, it's just an executable file. Same thing. Already has your company information in there. There's no way they can edit it. It just installs silently. On the Mac, it's a menu bar application, and on the PC, it's a status bar. My only complaint, I guess, so far with the, I guess, installation slash usage of it is this is not just me wanting this. I had a user ask for it. I wish you could make the menu bar item black and white. It's green, has a little green, I guess, a green dot in it, kind of saying everything's good. I wish you could make that just be like maybe a check mark, or I like everything being black and white. You know, Dropbox by default is blue. It's a blue box, but you can change that to be a black and white. And so again, it's kind of a breeze. You just install that, you're good to go. There's really nothing the user has to do. And then from the dashboard, you can run reports based, what that user has done, or just shown like what they've done that's blocked. It kind of shows which user has been the most active, had the most DNS request. You can have varied policies. So like we have a strict policy on site. But then when they roam off site, it becomes a much more lax policy. So basically, we're blocking lots of things internally, category wise. All of OpenDNS's are categories, and you can add exceptions as well. And then when it goes off site, we basically just block adult content. And so it's really nice. You could even set certain computers had certain restrictions. So let's say you wanted to have kind of more controlled policy on student computers, but you wanted to have different policies on teacher computers. Very, very easy to do that. There's a setting you can set it when, let's say, if you're already an enterprise user of OpenDNS, you can have it to turn off the Umbrella service when they're on campus. They just go with your kind of default network. Again, you kind of can't beat it from a simplicity standpoint. It's easy to install, nothing really to do. I've had no users complain about it. Actually, I had said one of them, it blocked the pop-up window for him. Actually showed that it blocked it. You can customize the block page. You can put your logo. You can put your email address if you think it should be, kind of whitelisted. Again, have no complaints. Mm-hmm. I think the complexity would be if you were trying to deploy that on a school with 300 kids that all had iPads. I think that could get very expensive. But from a, I guess, you know, if you're a general business customer and you have, you have 30 to 50 users you're wanting to deploy, I mean, from a simplicity standpoint, you write one check and it's covered. And not only that, but it is blocking for content. But if you're like a PC user, it's also a really, really good malware detector as well. It, you know, blocks it by default. And I've got a buddy that manages IT for a telco, and he said that OpenDNS is their only malware filter internally now because it's the only thing he trusts.
Interesting. So for those of people who maybe weren't listening back when we discussed Umbrella at the start, what we're talking about here is a cloud-based VPN, which will take your traffic not back to your site, but through OpenDNS's VPN servers, through their filtering, and then from there to the internet. So you're not necessarily bringing the traffic back onto your site and then out from your connection and back again, which is, I think, really useful for schools that maybe don't have very symmetric internet connections, for example. So you're not, people's download speeds are not then capped by your site's upload speed, which would be an issue certainly for us because we're our connection is very asymmetric. Let me ask you a question, Bradley, about Mac deployment on that. It uses its a native application. It's not using macOS 10's built-in VPN client. Is that right?
Well, I don't think on the Mac that it's actually a VPN client. I think the reason they did that on iOS is because it's the only way they could install it. I mean, they didn't really have a way to do that. It's actually a menu bar application. And if you go to your network settings, and it's basically forcing, you know, the whole idea of OpenDNS, I guess, of their enterprise service, I guess I'll back it up, is we tell them what our static IP is. And so anything they see DNS traffic from our static IP, they know what policy to apply to it. So basically, from what I gather, that menu bar application is forcing your traffic through OpenDNS, and they've also got, I guess, registered that you're an Umbrella customer, and then that's how kind of they apply the policy to it. So, like, if you go into your network settings, I think it's, I can't even remember what it says. It's not OpenDNS's usual settings, but I think it's somehow funneling your DNS settings, like on your network adapter, like either your Wi-Fi or your Ethernet, through that menu bar item somehow. I'm not for sure exactly how it's working, but I don't think on the desktops that it's an actual VPN.
So it's not actual VPN there. Okay. I've only tried it on iOS. I haven't tried it on the Mac. And on iOS, the way it works is it just, you download a configuration profile, which has credentials for a VPN service. And my complaint from an iOS point of view was that there was an automatic VPN setting and a manual VPN setting, but you could turn off the automatic VPN so that you could essentially take off all the protections if you wanted to. So I think if there was another way to configure that so that you only had the automatic one and you didn't have the option to turn it off, I think that would be more kind of bell and braces security for a school situation for younger users. But yeah.
And it's theoretically possible, like if you're the admin of your machine, to uninstall the OpenDNS client. There's actually there's a folder in your application folder that allows you to uninstall it. And if you really knew, I guess, what you were doing, you could try to kill it in Activity Monitor. But you can see in the dashboard, like, if a user's been offline. And so, like, if you consistently saw someone offline when you're pretty sure they should be online, you can kind of investigate further. But again, if the user's not the admin of their machine, there's no way they could do that. Yeah, I would love to see, I guess, the iPad one where somehow either it wouldn't allow it to be removed, or as soon as it got removed, it kind of phoned home and said, hey, you know, John Smith's VPN client has been turned off.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a time delay there. You know, it's something like if it doesn't see this client within 3 hours or something, it'll send you an email. I forget the exact detail, but it's something like that. But yeah, good service. I think the pricing needs a little adjustment for schools, I think, like you said. But I guess as it rolls out and as people express more interest in it, then I think it's something that... technologically, I think is what I'm trying to say is technologically it's a great solution. It's just the configuration and the pricing that I think could be tweaked a little bit.
And it seems like they kind of base their pricing on, again, users and not necessarily, like, say, devices or traffic. And
yes.
So I guess a lot of their cost is really in traffic, though. Obviously, the more you send to them, the more servers they need and things like that. So I guess the hope is they see that maybe as you know, it may be like, you know, 10 students do this, do the traffic in a week that one, you know, executive would, or one kind of Fortune 500 businessman would, or businesswoman. And so they can begin to kind of say, okay, we're going to have, you know, kind of school licenses, or, you know, maybe they can even work out some sort of deal with Apple where they say, okay, you can add this onto your lease, or, you know, with your iPads. I don't know. It's something where you could just buy it in bulk for, you know, 100 iPads or 300 iPads that would just come, you know, get that included. Because again, you know, we want to say that when those iPads go home, that it's not your problem. But as soon as something, you know, a student does something that a parent doesn't like, they're going to be calling you wondering, you know, why didn't you stop this?
Yeah. So we'll keep an eye on that. We'll keep reporting, and we'll see what happens with that. Cool. Last thing I've got here is, I was going to mention about, I mentioned earlier about the conference that I was running last week in Edinburgh, and I just thought I'd kind of mention a few points that came out of that, because it was quite interesting. What I had done a few weeks ago was designed essentially a day's worth of training based around the idea of going one-to-one in your school. So the thing I saw a lot of people struggling with is that they knew how to buy iPads. You know, buying the kit's always the easy part, right? You go to the Apple store, you get three or something. But a lot of people I talked to, or who came to visit the school or something, they said, well, we've got these few, but we'll never go one-to-one. And they were absolutely definite about that. And sometimes it was money, sometimes it was organizational things, or they just didn't, it just looked like too much of a job. And what I wanted to do was I was concerned that I saw a lot of people buying iPads and basically doing it wrong when they got them into their school. And I was concerned that the whole idea of iPads in school was going to go south, because people were going, there was going to be created a body of evidence that it doesn't work. In fact, we know it does work as long as you do it certain ways. And one of the things that I wanted to kind of talk to people about was using iPads on carts versus going one-to-one. And, you know, more and more, I know you use iPads and carts, Bradley, but more and more I've kind of been thinking in my head that there's something like 10 times the amount of effort required to keep a one-to-one, a cart situation under control than a one-to-one, just because of you've had talked on several occasions about your travails with Apple Configurator, and just trying to keep that all in line. And I think I wanted to kind of get people who were interested together for a day and just sort of tell them everything I knew about what works and what doesn't work when you're deploying iPads. So we did that, and there were 17 schools came along. It was organized by the Scottish Council of Independent Schools, which is a kind of representative body for private schools in Scotland, of whom Cedars is a member, along with all of the others, I believe. And we had a good representation. And crucially, I think this is really important, we had representation from sort of deputy heads and senior people in the school. And it wasn't just the enthusiast teacher or the IT guy who was there, but it was people, you know, with a senior role in deciding policy and strategy for schools, and I thought that was very valuable. So the way I broke it down was three sessions of about an hour and 15 each. The first session was all about, and this is kind of new material for the kind of things I've talked about before, and a lot of it came from the book that I mentioned earlier, Never Mind the Laptops, thinking about, you know, exactly why do you bring a computer into the classroom? What's it for educationally? And I kind of set it out in several ways, but looking at it from a sort of triangle, if you can imagine, with computer-aided instruction at the top, where the pupil sits down at a computer and clicks through training materials or something, and therefore sort of learns something. And then the idea of the computer as a tool for the teacher, and then the idea of the computer as a tool for the learner. And one of the things I did at the start was I asked the delegates to kind of place themselves right now on this, somewhere between these three points. You know, are you training people with content, you know, Khan Academy style, or are you deploying smart boards and controlled labs where the whole thing is really a tool for the teacher to administer some kind of lesson in the classroom? Or do you think, as I think, that you know, in the kind of Seymour Papert / Alan Kay philosophy that the computer is there to amplify the learner's own understanding and their experience of information and knowledge in the world. So that was the first kind of session in the day. And then we had a very interesting just sort of round the tables discussion about where people were at and what their plans were and what they were thinking. And one of the things that I was very pleased about was that a lot of the schools there had taken the infrastructure question really seriously at the start. And a lot of them said things like, well, we don't have very many iPads or anything like that, but we are taking Wi-Fi very seriously and looking at our bandwidth first, and then we're going to look at what device comes onto the network after that. And I thought that was really heartening, because up until that point, I talked to a lot of schools where they had got the iPads but no Wi-Fi, which is kind of the cart before the horse a little bit, I think. So that was good. And then the second session was all about operational issues. And that was really the kind of brass tacks of if you want to actually get these things off the crate, out the box, what are the things you have to think about to get them from being non-functional, non-activated devices to things that people have in their hands? And one of the things that I learned from the crowd at that point was that a lot of people who had been thinking about one-to-one in the crowd had misestimated the amount of effort required for certain parts of the operation. So they'd identified several things you have to do. You know, you have to activate them, you have to put some apps on, you have to set up some things, put some restrictions on, and so on. And the point I wanted to make to everybody was, look, the most important thing to get right is the Apple ID structure and who owns the apps and who pays for them. And a lot of people came to me in the breaks and afterwards and said, look, I'm really glad you did that, because we thought that was just going to be the easy part, that you just put some apps on and you go. When in fact, the point I was making, that that was one of the things that I had seen that had caused more heartache and more deployments than anything else. You know, you can fix the Wi-Fi, you can fix, you know, your broadband, you can get a faster connection or whatever in the most cases, but if you get the Apple ID structure wrong, you're going to have to kind of start from scratch all over again. So that was the middle section, was all about operational issues. And then the last part was about policy and communication. And that was more looking at things like acceptable use policy and communication with parents was a big one. And also media strategy as well. So communicating with journalists and newspapers and television about the project that you're involved in, because I've seen situations where, you know, schools have been ready to do something and then a negative news story puts the brakes on the whole thing or even kills it. And I wanted people to just be aware of that as well. And that was one thing that actually a lot of people said to me afterwards, we hadn't even thought about doing that. And it was good to get some of that stuff across. So that's a whole new day that I can do for anybody that is interested in hearing that content or having that delivered worldwide. I guess I can travel if you like. I think it's something that is kind of, it's like a one day distillation of everything I've kind of learned from first principles over the past 3 years of deploying iPad in school. And I think the key thing to take away from it is that there's a lot of effort required to go one-to-one, but it's not an infinite amount of effort. And once you've thought about all of these things, you can then go ahead and do it with a lot of confidence that it's actually going to work correctly. And that was the key point to get over in that day.
I guess two follow-ups I'll have on, you know, number one, on the cart deployments, that I'll agree with your statement that it is immensely harder to deal with carts from a licensing perspective, from a, you know, some things not working right perspective. You know, when you go one-to-one, the students become so comfortable, they kind of self-manage themselves. You know, they're not going to mess with the settings on something that's theirs, because then it's their responsibility to fix it. And so, yeah, I'll agree. You know, we have a lot of discussions internally about when we make that jump, and how do we, I guess, roll that out, you know, in a systematic way. And it's something that we still talk about, you know, really on a weekly basis. And on the Apple ID front, I talked to two schools last week for, both of them over an hour and a half. One was over lunch, and then one is at a school here in town that hired me to come by after school and kind of do some consulting on Apple Configurator itself, on how you manage that and things like that. And this one school is a K-12, and they are one-to-one in middle and high school, and then they're a cart-based in elementary school. And so we talked kind of extensively about the Apple ID structure of a cart-based deployment versus their one-to-one. And we kind of walk through systematically, you know, how those Apple IDs need to be structured, you know, in Apple Configurator. And then I told them, you know, I said, hey guys, you know, on your next lease, when they're probably about, I think, a year away from starting their next lease, I said, if it was me, for your middle and high school students, I might literally hand them an iPod or an iPad still wrapped in the box with either a gift card or a list of apps they must provide. Like, get out of the, you know, if you can get out of that business of application licensing, get out of it. Because again, if you, and that's one of those things where, you know, once you kind of go down a path, you're kind of stuck on it. It's not really easy to fix that. Again, like you said, you can fix the Wi-Fi, you can add some access points, you can change vendors, you know, you can change email providers. But if you don't get that core app licensing model down, it's kind of a you know, train to nowhere.
Yeah, you're definitely going to feel that for a long time to come. The other thing we talked about in that operation session that I forgot to mention was I developed a few slides that were talked about what it looks like in the long term, depending on the rollout strategy that you use in school. And there's three rollout strategies that I see a lot of schools going for. And it's not always clear to me that people have understood the consequences of these different strategies. And the first one is what I kind of term a year-by-year roll-up, where every incoming first class gets the current device, and then they take it on, and the next class gets a new device, and then they take it on. So you end up kind of over the course of, you know, 3 or 6 years, depending on the stage of your school, eventually getting to one-to-one. And there's two things in that model that I wanted to highlight with a slide, and one was that there's a kind of triangle of despair in that table, if you like, which is the group who's 1 year ahead of the first stage in the first year that you roll out. And then they have to go through maybe 5 years, and at least it would be in Scotland, 5 years of secondary school, looking at the year below having iPads, having one-to-one, and they will essentially never, ever get them. And that's, we've seen that done in some schools in the world, and that's a very easy way to import a massive resentment problem into your school. If there's a group who are going to, if there's a dividing line between those who will and those who won't get a device, and that line is hard forever because of the strategy that you're doing, you've got a lot of people very unhappy for quite a lot of years that they're not going to be part of it. So I was kind of cautioning people against that. And the second consequence of that is that because devices roll over every year to new models and so on, that if everybody keeps their device for 3 years, but you get a new one for the incoming group every year, you end up in a situation where you're running three or more generations of the device, depending on how quickly you refresh. You're running up to three generations of the device concurrently every year in your school. And it's incredibly hard to kind of get off that train unless you buy people a device for 1 year or something like that. And that strategy makes total sense in the first 3 years. But in the fourth year, in the fifth year, in the sixth year, and every year after that, it's not a world that you want to be in. So that's that was something that I highlighted. The second one was doing a pilot scheme with a view to a full rollout, where the privileged group, usually the first year, will get their devices a year ahead. Nobody else has them. But then the next year, you get that current device for everybody. And the payback for being the early adopter for the first group is that they get to keep an older device for the 3 years. And then everybody else sort of refreshes on a reasonable cycle. And I think that can work. I think most school communities are in a situation where a year's pilot is not unreasonable, but you have to be able to tell a story to everybody else about how they're going to be brought into the fold in short order after that. I don't think you can just pilot forever and you know, sort of by osmosis eventually get to a point where a lot of people have got devices, because that's not leadership, that's just letting it happen. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, going back to your kind of the cycled rollout and things like that, you know, even from looking at it from a technical perspective, let's look at the iPad. So if you had a group of your, let's say your students, you had maybe your high school for whatever reason had the first generation iPads, and then your lower school had the iPad 2. Well, let's look at what's different. So your iPad 1 would still be on iOS 5. your iPad 2 would then be on iOS 6, which that's one thing with the iOS applications. When they require 6.0, you kind of got different policies for different grade levels, and it can really become a mess. But let's look at it from a technical, or really a technical perspective. Since the iPad 1 doesn't support iOS 6, it also doesn't support 802.11r, which is the Wi-Fi Alliance's roaming standard. Now, not that the iPad 1, it can't roam, but it doesn't follow what the Wi-Fi Alliance considered. It's basically its roaming certification among access points. So in our experience, I've had much better roaming out of anything other than an iPad 1 on iOS 6. Well, then, okay, let's say, you know, again, you've got iPad 1 and iPad 2. So let's say you had those, but then we're going to bring in some iPad minis and some, you know, you're going to have the fourth generation iPads. Well, the iPad mini and the fourth generation iPad, from my understanding, now support 40 megahertz channel width on wireless, which is dramatically faster.
Yep.
But you really want to go to 40 megahertz channels when you've got the kind of the majority of your clients that can take advantage of that, because you are cutting your airtime in half when you do that. You can have 220 megahertz channels, or, you know, 140 megahertz. And so, like, you know, you kind of, those kind of technical decisions you have to make. Well, half of our clients can do 40 megahertz, but half of them can't. And, well, these support the roaming standard, but these don't. And so what invariably happens is you go to the lowest common denominator. You have to go what the lowest client can support. So if you've got, you wouldn't be able to take advantage of the new features of your new iPads.
And as a consequence, it can then end up being years and years and years until you can turn on a feature, you know. And if you have, you know, Wi-Fi like we have with Aerohive or some other vendor that is delivering new capabilities to their base stations with software updates, as they tend to do, you can just, you know, you've got that capability there, but you can't turn it on until you expire these last devices from years ago that, you know, only some people have got. So you end up kind of getting onto this train of even small innovations can end up taking a long time. And from a teaching point of view and a classroom point of view, every new generation brings new operating systems, brings new capabilities, brings new applications. You know, I mean, we've on our iPad 1s, we still can't run iMovie and iPhoto, for example. So then if you're a teacher in a secondary school, for example, and you've got some classes coming in, and they've got newer devices than other classes that are coming in, you've got to keep that in mind. You know, it's kind of almost halfway house to bring your own device. You've got to bear in mind which classes are coming in with which devices, therefore which kind of capabilities. And again, I think the same situation applies, that you probably just fall back to the lowest common denominator, which is, you know, everybody's got Pages and everybody's got the web, so let's just do that, you know.
Well, and look at iOS 6. So let's say, you know, let's say for whatever reason, your middle school students had iPad 2s with iOS 6, and when it came to exam time, you got a hold of those devices and turned on guided access. Well, your high school students, your high school teachers, that's a great feature. I want to do that for our exams. Well, you still have the iPad 1, so that's not a feature for you guys yet. And of course, you know, we as technical people like kind of get that, but they don't understand that. They say, look, we have, because I actually had a parent from another school who I used to work with. That they're doing a one-to-one program for middle school and high school at that school, and they're requiring a minimum of iPad 2. And he said, look, my son's already got an iPad 1. Why are they requiring an iPad 2? And I explained to him, it's iOS 6. That they're wanting iOS 6 as the baseline for it. And the iPad 1 is limited in RAM. And, you know, of course, once I explained that to him, he fully got it. He's kind of a computer person anyways, but he's not necessarily an iPad person. So he understood then. It's kind of like saying we want everything having Windows 7, but your computer has XP. It's still a computer, and it still may work fine. It just doesn't have the features that we require as the baseline, because you've got to create a baseline, and you want to create that baseline as high as possible, because again, it's not like you're getting full new gear every year. You know, as you said, it cycles. Going back to that pilot program, you start a pilot program, and then those people don't get new devices until basically 4 years, because if you do a pilot for a year and then do a 3-year lease, those folks are 4 years out on any sort of software updates or any new features. And It is, you've got to think long term with these programs and say, what does this look like in 2.5 years? Are we pulling our hair out over this? And if so, let's make some changes now to prepare for that.
Yeah. And I think that was a very useful discussion to have. And it was interesting to me how few schools in that session had considered leasing even at all, you know, because these are schools which are private schools, they're fee-paying schools, they've typically got a fair amount of money available to them. If they want to spend a lot of money, they could do so, and certainly have access to finance like that. So, but, you know, the world that we're in now, you know, where you, or we used to be in, where you could have bought a whole lab and, you know, kept it for an arbitrary amount of time and just, you know, refresh it whenever it seems to be too old because the desktop PCs weren't changing that fast. I think, you know, leasing is in general the right option when you're in a world where the technology is changing rapidly, as we are with these devices right now. So it was interesting just to kind of understand where other people are at in their thinking and what they're looking at. And I thought it was a really valuable day. I certainly hope some more interest will come of it.
I've actually got some fans of yours coming for a visit tomorrow. I had a school that's not too far from here that they sent me an email and said, "Hey, we've been a big follower of Fraser's blog for a while now. We found his podcast, and then we happened to find your website and realized that you're not very far from us. Can we come by and chat?" So they're going to come by in the morning and talk about infrastructure and about they're wanting to do more iPads in their elementary school, and so they're wanting to kind of talk about that. So yeah, you have some fans that I guess they did not know I was from Chattanooga, and it's been funny. A guy at our local Mac Authority, it's one of the Mac resellers here in town, found the show and then realized that I was in the same town he was, and every time I go on Mac Authority now and we get to talk. But again, he came for the show because he followed you. So you've got a following here in the southern United States.
Glad to pull in the freight. What can I say? yeah, I was going to just mention something about the blog. I posted a thing yesterday, which actually came out of the session that we did last week. Which the post was called "Beyond Content Consumption Versus Creation," and the idea was it's something I've been kicking around in my head for a couple of weeks about the idea that the analysis between you know, the simplistic analysis that people did back in 2010 was, oh, the iPads for content consumption and real computers are for content creation. I've always wanted to get away from that, but it never kind of came together as to what the actual correct construction was. And I think I finally cracked it, at least at one level, which was to think about it not as a consumption versus creation problem as much as it's a task duration versus task complexity problem. And we'll stick the link to the blog in the show notes so people can go and see this visually for themselves. But what I did was I developed a kind of chart where I looked at two axes with task complexity on the vertical axis and task duration on the horizontal axis, and placed on there three bands, if you like, one being smartphones, one being iPad, and one being traditional desktop PCs, in which I also include laptops. And sort of as you go away from the origin towards the top right corner, you move through smartphones, which can handle moderately complex tasks for a short period of time or simple tasks for quite a long time. And then iPad has this very kind of sweet band right in the middle of increasingly complex tasks that are doable for an increasingly great length of time. And some tasks, in fact, are always preferable on the iPad rather than on a desktop computer. I'm thinking, you know, reading documents, for example, which, you know, the widescreen laptop versus the portrait screen tablet are two ways of looking at that. And then obviously in the top right corner, the tasks of incredible complexity and doing them for a long period of time, you know, any task where you see people with two 30-inch monitors on their desk, software development, video editing, CAD CAM, all of those things are still out of the reach of tablets. But also there are some tasks which are of such high complexity that regardless of how long or short you want to do them for, the iPad can't quite reach there yet. And I was thinking about things in that case, like either the device is simply not powerful enough, it doesn't go fast enough, or it doesn't have enough storage. Incidentally, the 128 gig iPad is one thing that will eat into that space quite quickly. Or the software hasn't been written yet because the APIs don't exist in iOS yet. Or possibly the App Store policy just doesn't allow it. So, for example, we could have a C compiler built for the iPad and that would work just fine technically and API-wise, but it wouldn't be allowed in the App Store because of policy. So There was some discussion about that on the blog and just how I think that these things fit together. And I think that's a useful new metric to look at it that way. And the reason I used it in that session was because my point I was trying to make to people was that this band of tasks in the middle, which are of moderate complexity, done for a moderate period of time, is almost exactly everything we do in school with a computer. So, you know, the day is split up into sections, and you don't sit down in the morning at 9 o'clock and work on one thing all day. Typically, you're doing, you know, 1 or 2 hours at a time on different tasks, and they're not typically of that incredible level of complexity that the iPad can't reach into yet. So that was kind of the point I was trying to make, was why I think iPad is still such a great computer for school, because it hits that the overlap between what the iPad's good at and what we do in school is almost total, in my opinion.
It, to me, it really goes back to the simplicity and the ease of use. I had a, you know, we have a couple of Promethean boards, and they're fine products, and they work well, but they can be incredibly complicated. The software, while in some ways is easy to use, it's incredibly difficult for a teacher to master it. And it's like a teacher was using it, and she plugged the little wireless USB dongle into her laptop. For whatever reason, the laptop recognized it, but it didn't connect it to the board. And so she called me, and I have to basically unplug it, plug it in 3 times, and it finally works. And she's lost 10 minutes of instruction time. And I just kind of pull my hair out, and she's not upset. She, you know, our teachers are wonderful, and you know, that stuff like that doesn't scare them off. But it pulls my hair out when it's like, these things should just work 100% of the time. It should be like, you know, 1 out of 100 that it shouldn't work perfect. And that, to me, is what we get with iOS. It's stripping away all the complexity of computing and really kind of saying, okay, if we were starting over today and we had none of our existing problems, what would it look like? And to me, iOS still fits that mold because, again, you know, it's uses your Wi-Fi network to do AirPlay to an Apple TV rather than using some custom dongle with a custom written driver that sits in the menu bar that for whatever reason didn't work.
Yeah, it's a broad rethinking of, you know, if everything's on the table, what would we do? And the choices, I think I really love iOS. I mean, the people who listen to the show know this, that I'm a crazy fan of iOS, but I just think it's... you know, I wrote a piece the day after the iPad was announced called Future Shock on my blog. And one of the things I said in that piece was, look, for years and years, we've claimed that we are building computers for everybody. And we're not, because there are just so many people who are just can't get over the complexity of some of the things that are in the computer. And as Steve Jobs famously put it, it's when they hit the file system that the complexity just goes way up. So Apple decided to do what they were going to do, which was basically to abstract away the file system. And, you know, the technical people like us are sort of freaking out, going, oh, where's my file system? Whereas users are like, that's the greatest thing ever. And I can't, you know, as somebody who taught people how to use computers in the OS X era, and who now teaches people to use computers in the iPad era, the directness of going from what it is you want to do to solving your task with a computer, that path is now so direct compared to what it was even on the Mac, which is a great operating system, don't get me wrong. And, you know, Windows 8 is interesting too, but iOS, the connection between what you want to do and how you do it is just so incredibly direct that I still can't see past it, to be honest with you.
It reminds me, I imagine that back when the GUI was first coming on and the people that were sitting at the command line said, that'll never work. And I mean, and you look what happened. And, you know, again, the other times I'm on iOS and I wish I had a little bit more control, maybe, but I'll tell you where it really hits home for me when I'm sitting down with a teacher and she says, I cannot find my files. I want to know where all my Word docs are. I want to know where all my Pages documents are. And on an iPad, it's very easy. You open up Pages, and it shows you all your Pages documents. You know, again, does that solve the need for every power user? Probably not. But I kind of look at it as, you know, you're building a machine that works for, the regular people. You know, the regular people are using these computers to do amazing things. And it kind of goes back to me, to our sponsor this week, Timeline 3D. things that make you look like you are a computer whiz, but you're just kind of an average user. That's, to me, the sign of a good system. It's kind of like a, you know, if I go buy a do-it-yourself, you know, a home repair kit for, you know, a clogged sink and it works, that's great. I don't care if it was like the way my plumber would have done it. I care that it worked for me that day and it allowed me to get the job done without having to call a professional.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think that, I mean, I'm always influenced by, there's a great video clip of Steve Jobs from, I think it is 1983 or 1984, just around the time of the launch of the Mac. But, and it was so kind of influential in my understanding of this whole thing that I sort of memorized the whole thing that he said. But what he said was that right now, if you have a problem that you want to solve and you want to use a computer to do it, we put a massive roadblock in your way, which is you first got to understand how to use a computer and then you get to solve your problem. And he said that the whole soul of Apple and everything that they were all about was to basically take that roadblock away so that you could go from the problem you wanted to solve directly to the solution without having to go through all the complexity of learning a computer. And when he was speaking, he was talking about the complexity of learning a command line and all that kind of stuff, and possibly even building your own software to solve the problem back in those days. But today, I think we're almost at the point where we've achieved that vision, where whatever problem you want to solve, there is indeed, to use the phrase, an app for that, because there are so many apps and they're so powerful that, you know, if you want to write or draw or play music or read a book or anything like that, there is a way that you can go directly from installing an app in the App Store to doing that thing. To essentially, and this goes back to the heart of why iPad is so great in schools, it's not just that you put that software on your computer, but by doing so, because of the design of iOS, you have essentially turned your iPad into that thing, or at least a simulation of that thing. So when you open up iBooks, it's a book. When you open up GarageBand, it's a musical instrument. When you open up ArtRage, it's a canvas to paint on, and so on and so on and so on, even into things that we haven't imagined yet. And to me, that's the most exciting thing for the next few years. As these devices get more powerful, have more storage capacity, get connected to better and better networks, LTE, better Wi-Fi, all of these things, that we can just turn these devices into even more new things that we can use to impact our world. And I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I always go back to, I guess, cars for my analogy, that I am not concerned with how my car runs. I really don't. As long as it kind of gets me to point A to point B, that's great. I have no interest in the manual transmission. Automatic transmissions are great for me. I know maybe a manual transmission is a little bit better gas mileage. Maybe the car runs better. Maybe I can go a little faster. I don't care. The automatic transmission works for me. I don't care really what kind of engine it has. I just want it to do its thing and get me to point A and point B. And I think as teachers, especially in their devices, whether it be a laptop, an iPad, a phone, they just want it, they have what they want and they want to get to point B where they find it or they do that. And it's such a more complex task on a Mac or on a PC.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think it kind of goes back to what I said in that Future Shock piece that I wrote a couple of years back, that the work that we are engaged in is not to manipulate the computer to eventually somehow solve that problem. The work we're engaged in is solving that problem. The computer is nothing but a burden if it gets in the way of solving that problem, whether the problem be to teach a child arithmetic or to serve in a restaurant or to work in a hospital or whatever it is we do, you know, fix a car by the roadside. If the computer is in the way of that, then the computer's failed in its task, in my opinion. And I think that's, we're starting to reach a very interesting point where it's not that exciting nowadays that, you know, there will be a new iPad and it'll be a bit faster and it'll have a better digitizer perhaps or whatever, I don't know. But I've always said that's not interesting. What's interesting is the software that enables people to do something new. And that's, to me, the most exciting thing about the whole operation that we're involved in here.
That was a whirlwind of a show.
Yeah, that's a good point to stop, I think. It's good to be back.
Yeah, glad to have you back. It was, I love having the guest on, but it's good to have you back. I love talking this, and I'm glad to get to talk to another school about this tomorrow. This is the kind of thing that I guess really gets me excited, because I want teachers and users to be able to do great things not necessarily to do great things with a computer. The computer is just a tool. Just for a carpenter, there's a, you know, hammer or a nail.
Absolutely.
So, anything else before we close?
I don't know if I've even mentioned this to you privately, but I spoke to Roshan Richards, who is the guy behind Explain Everything, which is a fantastic educational application, and he's agreeing to come on the show and chat to us about that. They've just released Explain Everything 2.0 in the App Store. It's an awesome upgrade. So I'm sort of pre-announcing his involvement in the show because I'd like everybody to have an opportunity to go and play with Explain Everything and then come back and hear from Roshan, and we'll talk to him about his ideas about why the app is the way it is and what he thinks its applications are in the classroom. So I'm really looking forward to that show. Maybe a couple of weeks till we can schedule them, but it's going to be great when we can get them.
We've got quite a few emails that have been sent to us that we've kind of, we will get to those at some point. We had planned on doing that this episode, but we got to talking, and so we may hit that, hit those emails next week or the next week. So if you're waiting on an answer, we promise we haven't lost your email. Thanks everybody for listening. Again, if you want to sponsor the show, you can send us an email at outofschool.net. Thanks to BDocs Timeline 3D for sponsoring the show this week. So if you haven't already, please leave a review in iTunes. That always helps new people find the show. So I guess have a good week, everybody. Goodbye.